You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nilsson does film. You can see his musings at filmology.com. It's spelt with a PH. Filmology is also his Twitter handle, and he and his friends are on Triple R. Josh, welcome.
Good afternoon.
So, we are going to talk about The Walk, which I'm very curious about, because I loved the original documentary. But first, The Wrecking Crew. Now, we've got some of the trailer, but a quick explanation. Who are they?
So The Wrecking Crew was a name given to a group of session musicians in the 1960s based in California. You've probably never heard of the names of most of these musicians, but you've certainly heard the music they've played on. Drummer Hal Blaine, very famous drummer, he was the one who reportedly dubbed them The Wrecking Crew because they would go in and they would basically wreck the joint, or they were accused of wrecking the music industry because they were too good. And then the bands who were getting the credit for the music couldn't actually replicate their instrumentation. So yeah, this documentary is done by
That's the bit I love the most.
Yeah, I mean,
no one could match them.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so many wonderful anecdotes in here. But it's directed by a guy called Denny Tedesco, who's the son of Tommy Tedesco, who was a guitarist as part of the Wrecking Crew. So it's part tribute to his father, but also to these broader group of musicians.
A little piece of the trailer.
When we're ready to sing, we step up at the microphones, and it comes out something like this.
We came in the studios with Levi's and T-shirts, smoking cigarettes. The older guys were saying they're going to wreck the music business.
In the hardcore producing area, everybody knew what went on there. I mean, everybody knew that the best musicians played in all the sessions, but we as the general public didn't know.
Can start singing All the Leaves Are Brown there if you wish.
I was just about to jump in there, yeah.
And even just with the trailer, you want to hear all of the song because you hear just these minor parts of a riff and you go, oh, I know that, I know that, I know that. So they're obviously incredibly prolific. But I'm interested in the film's genesis because it took a while to get to air.
It has taken quite a while. This is two decades in the making. So the film began, I think, well, while a lot of the Wrecking Crew were still alive, some of them have since passed. So it began in the mid to late 1990s. I think Danny Tedesco went and started interviewing these predominantly guys, but one very famous woman who I'm going to talk about in just a moment. And interestingly, it took until 2008 to get a festival release, and mainly festivals in the States. And then they couldn't get a release because, and you'll understand once you see the film, the amount of music and the rights and the cost involved of getting all the rights to that music has taken 7 years and a very heavy Kickstarter campaign. I think something like $300,000 to just to get the rights to the money. So now it's finally in cinemas, which lends the film a strange tone because the look of it looks a little like a 90s made-for-TV documentary, you know, Pan and Scan. A lot of the people who are talking, people like Cher, looks like Cher did in the 90s, and she certainly doesn't look like that now.
Right.
But it has this sense of reflection too, because you get sort of subsequent interviews where they come back and you see the musicians age again and you see a whole new sort of raft of anecdotes.
And Brian Wilson's in it.
Brian Wilson isn't. Look, Glenn Campbell. But the wealth of music is just incredible. The Sinatras, Cher, Mamas and Papas, the Monkees, the Carpenters, Nat King Cole, the Ronettes, we go on and on. But one of my favourite bits is when they talk about Pet Sounds. And having seen Love and Mercy, the biopic that came out a couple of months ago, and my favourite parts of that film were the recording sessions from Pet Sounds, you just get a sense of how incredible these musicians were and how much they actually enjoyed working for Wilson and performing on that music.
So it's a good doco.
Oh, look, I really enjoyed it. This is a music lover's documentary for lovers. I mean,
but do you need to know much about music? They're all pretty familiar, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, this is popular music in the 1960s and also film music. I mean, one of my favourite interviewees from the film, a woman named Carol Kay, who's described as possibly the best bass player ever to come out of the States. You see her play the riff to the Mission Impossible thing. That was her. She took on that. I think Lalo Schifrin composed it, but you see her come up with the riff and talk about that. And she's a standout. And in an era of 60s where she's surrounded by men, the whole document takes on a sort of an interesting angle given the gender context. And you see some of the guys in a later interview, almost in like an episode of Sopranos, they're all sitting around a darkened table like they're playing a poker game, reflecting on their good old days. And I think it may have been Tedesco says, geez, I'm glad there weren't sexual harassment laws back in the day because we would have owed you millions.
Yeah, right.
And they're just sort of playing. Like she owns it. She's great.
Interesting. Okay. It is called The Wrecking Crew. They are, that's the musicians behind so many different fantastic and famous sounds. Is it on wide release, Josh?
Sadly, it isn't.
That's okay.
Guess where it's on?
Yeah, I think it might be on at the Nova. But that's cool. We like the Nova. They're nice. And, good food around there. But your suggestions for good music documentaries. Look, I'll get this out of the way. Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind. Yes, absolutely. Many of you texting them in. The best documentary of all time is undoubtedly Spinal Tap, no question. There are many texts along those lines. Another text, haven't heard of it, Anvil. A doco on a Canadian metal band that never made it but influenced Guns N' Roses, which I think I've read about. Have you seen that?
I have. It actually reminded me a lot of Spinal Tap, but they're real. That's the, right. Yeah, that's the thing.
Okay. A little bit of... you might have seen these ones. Actually, I think... Have I seen this one? Anyway, the Metallica doco. Prizes if you guess the year. And just text in that if you know the title to the Metallica doco.
This is so weird because you guys were just supposed to film us making an album. And all of a sudden we just set our instruments down and started talking. And the next thing you know, we have a movie about a really dark time in Metallica.
I was straight up with you.
I think it's stock. Which part of that is unclear to you?
What have you been doing?
Picking at me all night.
Save up the tension. Tension produces results.
Have you seen that one?
I have.
Good.
It's one of my favorite music documentaries.
Right.
So that's Some Kind of Monster, 2004.
2004, yes.
What a bunch of prima donnas.
Right.
You know, these are the hard rock kind of gods, heavy metal gods, and they're hiring a psychiatrist, paying him something like $40,000 US a week. And
a week?
And he's creating all these rifts in amongst the band. He's making it worse just to sort of maintain his presence. And then he becomes the catalyst because they turn on their shrink, and that's what unifies them in the
right.
end. It's sort of a remarkable documentary.
Oh, great.
But, yeah, all these, it's an eye-opener to the process of guys who've made it rich and are still trading off their
rock
hard,
and roll.
Hard rock down
stay
to
evil.
Earth. Exactly, yeah.
Except, you know, you need a $40,000 bill to stay evil. Per week. 1300 222 774. If you've got a good music documentary, a favourite music documentary or a dreadful one you care to share. Gaz in Geelong saying Bob Dylan, No Direction Home by Martin Scorsese. I haven't seen any of these. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, Josh, fantastic.
Yep. Yeah, good. Okay. And there's one called Finding Fela Kuti, the African musician. Seen that one?
No, I know of it, but I haven't seen it. Yeah.
And Searching for Sugar Man.
Yeah. You weren't a fan?
Yeah.
The biggest complaint about Searching for Sugar Man...
It's deceptive. Searching for Sugar Man's not the real story.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Yeah.
The problem is they make it such a sort of a cat and mouse game of, is Sugar Man alive still?
Yeah,
we're going to find him.
Completely...
But most people are like, yeah, well, I saw him a couple of years ago. He
it's
played
Hogan.
At the Arts Centre.
That's
yeah.
right. That's the biggest flaw. Like, it's great if you don't know the real story.
Yeah.
And then you find out the facts and it's like, I just got hoodwinked by a documentary. Simon's called from Listerfield. Simon, what's yours?
Hey, Raph, and how you doing, Josh?
Good.
Josh, I, like you, really agree that it brings love and mercy to life, because when you see those scenes in the movie, you go, wow, this is really, really his respect for them as musicians, but not only that, but how great he was as a composer to think of those sorts of people playing.
Right.
It reminded me a lot, guys, of Standing in the Shadows of Motown.
Actually, look, we've got a little bit of that. Let's have a listen, and then you can tell us why you liked it.
In 1959, Berry Gordy gathered the best musicians from Detroit's thriving jazz and blues scene to cut songs for his new record company. Over a 14-year period, they were the heartbeat on My Girl, Bernadette, I Was Made to Love Her, and every other hit from Motown's Detroit era. By the end of their phenomenal run, this unheralded group of musicians had played on more number one hits than the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, Elvis, and the Beatles combined. Which makes them the greatest hit machine in the history of pop music.
Now, Simon, I'm glad you nominated that. What's
it
the power of that?
It just resonated with me, Raph, because I kind of thought it was the Tamala version of the, say, California sound and what have you.
Mm.
And, Josh, you're right about that bass player, because the original bass line for When the Beat Goes On wasn't that beautiful boom, 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 boom. It was just this one monotone note. So I loved it. Great call.
Fantastic, Simon. Okay, here's the question, too, that I'll put out to you. There is something particular about the music documentary. Now, I don't know if you can actually encapsulate this in words, but my favourite is the BBC multi-part The History of Rock and Roll Dancing in the Streets, which also has not been reproduced on DVD because they can't afford the rights, because it's just they've got everyone in there, Bowie, you know, the remaining members of the Sex Pistols, like everyone. They can't afford to get copyright for the interviews and the songs. But what is the power? There's something about, I think when you're watching a music documentary, someone is putting into words and making concrete the ephemeral joy and ecstasy you have when you first hear the music. Is that why they're so, I mean, they're particularly enjoyable in a way other documentaries are not?
Yeah, look, there's no particular formula for music documentaries. I mean, some trade off the sort of the cultural importance of the of the work or the historical context. Others focus on this sort of idea of artistic genius and artistic merit. I mean, one of the most remarkable documentaries, although it's probably more a concert film, is U2 3D, because it gives you a sense of what it feels like.
Yes.
I mean, it's an IMAX film, to be Bono on stage in front of 200,000 people at Wembley Stadium. And that is something
that
it's that kind of quite remarkable.
Like, I mean, it's very different to the Motown one, and I imagine to the Wrecking Crew. However, something about the music doco captures the lightning in the bottle.
Absolutely.
And it's so hard to do that with music. I just maybe would just enjoy seeing it up on screen. Look, I'll get to more of your calls. 1300-222-774 is the phone number. Also, Walk With Me, the extraordinary documentary about the Frenchman, the Nutter, really, who crossed on a wire from one tower to the other of the World Trade Center. It's been made into a proper fictionalized type version with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. We'll find out about that in a moment. Stan's call from Carlton with a music documentary. Stan, what's yours?
Hi, Raph. Josh, how are you? Look, Tommy Tedesco, you may not know this, but he has been classified as the most recorded guitarist in history because of his involvement in the 60s.
Right, because he's just but on what? So many albums.
Oh, unnamed. Raph, unnamed.
Fantastic.
However, what the Wrecking Crew is to musicians, another documentary that came out this year is called 20 Feet from Stardom. It is to backing singers, the unknown backing singers of iconic music of the 50s, 60s, 70s, as what the Wrecking Crew is to musicians. Highly recommended.
Okay, 20 feet from Stardom.
Compelling viewing.
Okay. Hey, Stan, you sound like a doppelganger for Glenn A. Baker, actually. I don't know if you're
really?
The right... Well, there's something in the accent there. I don't know. Did you go to the same school, grow up in the same area or something?
No accent, I'm afraid, Raph. No? Australian born and bred.
No, Glenn A. Baker is right. There's a similar Australian accent. But anyway, 20 feet from Stardom. We'll put it in the memory bank. And one other worth a mention, by the way, the fantastic Amy Winehouse film, which is just extraordinary because they've got access to so many pieces of video footage. That's worth a mention.
On 774 ABC Melbourne, you're listening to Raphael Epstein. Call now on 1300 222 774 or text 0437 774 774. You're with
Raph. Josh Nelson is with me. We were talking about the music doco Wrecking Crew. However, Josh, The Walk, we've got a bit of the trailer. What's it all about?
This is about a Frenchman named Philippe Petit who crossed between the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center in 1974. It was the subject, I think, as you mentioned earlier, of a fantastic documentary produced in 2008 called Man on Wire. And now Robert Zemeckis has taken a semi
Back to the Future,
fictionalized.
Man on Wire. Yeah.
Also Forrest Gump, let's not forget that one. Castaway.
Crime.
And Flight, which we disagreed on a couple of years ago, with Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the Frenchman, Philippe Petit.
Although, mind you, the Frenchman he advised on this, and he actually taught Joseph Gordon-Levitt to typewrite.
Right.
So he was heavily involved in the process. Anyway, let's have a little listen to the trailer.
And people ask me, why do you risk death? For me, this is life.
Welcome to New York. Anything to declare?
I'm going to hang a high wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center and walk on it.
Good lark.
No matter where I was going or what I was doing, I was always searching, looking for the perfect place to hang my wire.
Whoa.
I need you to help me pull this off.
I got just the guys.
Now it starts.
Yeah, I don't know, Josh. I watched the Man on Wire trailer today to remind me. I've seen it, and it sent shivers down my spine. I just listen to that poor French accent, and I run screaming. Is it worth seeing?
Not for the accents, Rav. Yeah, boy, it took me a while. I mean, there is an almost a similarity at points in the film between Levitt's accent and Petit. Petit has almost like a stereotypical French accent, as you know, when he's speaking
he
in
looks
English.
Like a joke character on screen.
Yeah, but having watched Man on Wire again this week, I probably shouldn't have done that in hindsight. I'm not sure that the two compare back-to-back all that well. The other thing, I mean, this is more with Zemeckis' style. I mean, this is a guy who trades off nostalgia and sort of lighthearted fare, I think. I mean, Back to the Future, who framed Roger Rabbit. Is he approaches this act like a pantomime. So there's the direct-to-camera address. Levitt, or the Petit character, is talking to the audience like he would be as a street performer. So it has almost a fairy tale openings to try and kind of bring the audience into it. And then it proceeds almost like a heist film. So the act itself is almost like pulling off the bank heist, arranging the team, setting it up, pulling off the final act. In saying that, it took two-thirds to get to the walk itself. I think it's worth it. I think cinematically it's worth it.
They went to a lot of effort to make it feel like you're on that high wire.
Yeah, I actually was sort of squirming in my chair a couple of times and both palms broke out in sweat.
Okay, so this is definitely, if you can see it in IMAX, do.
And 3D. The 3D was actually worth it for this one. Okay. This is not just a kind of gimmick to get bums on seats. It's actually, I think, been made with 3D in mind. The one bugbear I do have is once they finally got to that extraordinary sort of set piece towards the end, it still tries to take artistic license where I don't think you need to.
No, the real story is extraordinary.
Yeah, so trying to sort of set up this idea of anything could go wrong at any moment. I mean, the beauty of Man on Wire is we know he's alive, he's talking to the camera, but we still think he's going to die.
But that's what's so extraordinary about the documentary.
Exactly, yeah. And this doesn't quite pull that off and doesn't pull off the sublime quality of the walk as well. I mean, visually, yes, it's striking. And if you ever want to know what it would have felt like to look down from a wire 110 stories.
So a classic Hollywood piece of style over substance.
It very much is a classic Hollywood film. Ben Kingsley's in there. He plays the mentor figure. Yeah. His accent's even worse. And the film seems conscious of the accents. There's so many lines where they say, we have to speak in English because we want to blend in New York. Yeah. And even references to Ben Kingsley. No one knew where he was from. And I think that was because no one could tell what his accent
was. Is there an Aussie? Because there's a great Aussie supporter.
This is the great omission. Because the documentary talks about his walk on the Harbour Bridge. And that Bill Williams, I think his name was then brought across to New York. He's completely omitted.
Oh, what a bummer, because that was one of the great features, very parochial.
And it would have been an interesting addition to a kind of multicultural, heist-type narrative. Okay. Look, I think this is worth it. If you're going to see it, you have to see it at the cinema. I think it would lose a lot on a small screen. But, yeah, just put the accent stuff to the side, the pantomime quality.
If you can.
And enjoy the visuals at the end.
Okay, and the walk is on kind of everywhere.
It's advanced screenings this weekend. It opens nationally on Thursday.
Okay. Stop Making Sense, someone texting in Wayne. Yes, definitely a good music doco. Margaret in Surrey Hills, what's your music doco?
Well, I like that 20 Feet from Stardom, except I thought it was 15 or 12 anybody
we'll
wants to follow it. I still like something that was probably on before you, either of you were born, the old Grey Whistle Test.
The old which?
Grey Whistle Test.
The Grey Whistle Test, what's that about?
The old Grey Whistle Test. It was on the ABC. And there was another one a few years ago of an elderly pianist and entrepreneur in New York who made sure that a whole lot of people who were dying of AIDS who were musicians or vocalists could get their time in the sun.
Yes, I remember that. I wish I could remember the name, Margaret, but thank you. We'll remind people of the old Grey Whistle Test.
The AIDS documentary I think she's referring to is All the Way Through Evening by Australian director Rowan Spong.
Yeah, that was extraordinary.
Yeah, we reviewed it last year or the year before.